Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Censored. I'm Aoife Vrutnach.
And I'm Lloyd Maeve-Houston.
And we're here to talk about The Graduate from 1967. This is so exciting to me.
Are you trying to record a podcast with me, Dr. Vrutnach?
Would you like me to record a podcast with you, Dr. Eustace? You started it now. Don't be looking so scandalized.
I think kind of might provide a segue into a certain aspect of like the potential disjunction between what this film is infamous for and what it's actually like mostly about.
I was really surprised to come up against my perception of the film versus watching it carefully, sitting with it, and paying really close attention. I don't really think it is about what I thought it was about. I mean, first of all, it's a great film.
Yeah, Jesus Christ, it is. It absolutely slaps. Like, it is such a good film.
Yeah, I mean, it deservedly has a reputation for being an incredibly important and brilliant piece of work.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think along with like Bonnie and Clyde and, you know, a couple of other things that came out in sort of 67, 68, it's one of those kind of, you know, landmark new Hollywood movies, and like deservedly so. It does feel like a kind of new or kind of, you know, fresh vocabulary is arriving in sort of Hollywood cinema for dealing with, you know, youth and desire and all the sort of things that this film grapples with. It's good stuff.
Oh, it's so beautifully shot. I mean, it's so rich. First of all, to watch it in the midst of, you know, our winter.
Yeah, that Los Angeles sun is just like, oh God.
It's the blue pool and the tanned, okay, arguably over-tanned skin. I mean, you did kind of have a moment of, ooh, factor 50, lads. Think about it.
Oh boy, yeah. We are going to be looking at some troubling moles, you know, 20, 30 years out from this.
But yeah, it is so lush.
And some very, like, deliberately sexily deployed tan lines, actually.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I know. I have to say, more shocked by the tan lines than the nudity.
Although, they kind of arrive in tandem, right?
I know, but I don't know why that is. I think that's just some weird flex. But what we should actually do is very briefly summarize, I suppose, what it is about. So yes. It's about Benjamin, who's coming back from college to live with his parents for the summer.
He's done very well for himself. Pride, 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 as one character sort of brays at him in that disorienting opening scene.
Yes, they are disturbingly proud of him. He apparently is a track star. He's head of the debating team, all of which seems completely unlikely when you see him kind of shuffle in and you're like, debating team? He can barely open his mouth. Are you like, he just seems the antithesis of all of what they've put around him.
Yeah, kind of pinned between a felt obligation to be the kind of young man that everyone is sort of touting him as, and you know, some incoherent desire to be something else. Until eventually, you know, back in his room, he is barged in on by, or captured by, the infamous Mrs. Robinson.
Yes, she comes into the room and she's just like, yeah, just drive me home. He's like, well, what?
Initially, she's like, I'm going to smoke here now. And she's like, do you have an ashtray? No, she doesn't. Just,
she puts the ash on the bed, doesn't she?
Yep. That was what I was going to say. To your point, yeah, from a kind of 2023 perspective, some of the shocking things in this are not the nudity or the sort of emotional content or anything else. It's, yeah, tan lines and people just like smoking everywhere and ashing all over themselves and the scenery.
I do think there's something so provocative, but also like brazen about how she just puts the ash on the bed, because she says, do you want to smoke? And he doesn't say yes or no. He kind of shrugs and she goes, oh, yes, the track star, as in, yeah, of course you don't smoke. And then she proceeds to be blatantly a smoker in front of a non-smoker. You know, there's something so I don't give a fuck, whatever.
Well, it's that in Tarantino movies, people always exert dominance by like eating each other's food or like eat, you know, and in this, it feels like there is a similar thing of like, you know, smoking, like the transacting of like drinks and like who smokes where. And, you know, just all these ways that like characters are kind of exerting their domain over spaces and stuff that's or kind of, you know, intruding upon another person's kind of almost like physical integrity in interesting ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a very much a power play, the way she smokes like that.
Mm. And smolder she does, my goodness.
Yeah, she's amazing. And one of the things that annoyed me about when I watched the documentary on the film is they kept saying how the film was all about Dustin Hoffman's character and how he is, you know, what makes the film. And I was like, I mean, of course, it's his breakout role. It makes him into a huge star. But I kind of feel like the talk about the film focuses on Benjamin and Dustin Hoffman way more than it does on the Mrs. Robinson character and how she's portrayed and what she's doing in the film. It's like, why?
Yeah, it's Anne Bancroft's movie at every inch as much as it's Dustin Hoffman's, and in many ways kind of more so, right? You know, his performance only makes sense with her as sort of foil to it, and, you know, or with him as foil to her performance for most of these sort of early phases of the movie. And like, in terms of the sort of emotional stakes of everything, it's, you know, she is the more, to my mind at least, the more poignant kind of figure, you know, by quite some way.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. That's how I felt as well. I did feel like the arc of the story that we're told is Benjamin, disaffected young man, needs to find some purpose in life, ends up having an affair, but sorts his life out at the end. And she's just the affair bit. But it's like, no. No.
Yeah, I was gonna say, we're doing a terrible job of summarizing this. We've gone straight into analysis because it's so kind of rich and dense. But yeah, I mean, I suppose just to do the really sort of crude, broad brushstrokes, the surface level narrative of this, because I think we probably do need to talk about, you know, what the film depicts versus like how it, you know, imbues it with significance. But yes, it's a quote-unquote kind of coming-of-age story. This guy, you know, comes back under all this burden of expectation, has this affair sort of begun upon him with Mrs. Robinson, who is the wife of his father's business partner. And I think, like, you know, could maybe taught him, I can't remember, when he was younger. But, and they, you know, spend this summer hooking up until her daughter arrives back also from college, at which point she forbids him from becoming involved with the daughter, which is something that his parents very much want to happen. And then he throws her over kind of for the daughter, which eventually comes to a head with the relationship between him and the mother being revealed, at which point the daughter is kind of whisked away, sent off to college, at which point he stalks her basically in a pretty uncomfortable sequence, until eventually it's revealed that the daughter is under the misapprehension that he raped the mother, which is the story that the mother sort of told about what happened that's kind of clarified. He continues to still be really like a creep show, to be honest, until he sort of browbeats her into marrying him, at which point, when that's revealed as a possibility, the daughter is again whisked away. He does the kind of like, you know, drive across the country, sprint through the city, get to the church on time thing. And just at the point that she's, you know, you may now kiss the briding, he has that, you know, kind of famous moment banging against the glass that I think The Simpsons has done the best sort of parody of. And he like battles his way through the church, hits a bunch of people with a crucifix. They like jams the door with it. They sprint out of the church together, get on a bus, and it initially seemed very giddy and happy with their, you know, elopement together, until maybe the tone shifts. But I guess that's the point at which we can talk about sort of tone in this movie. But yeah, so it's notionally his kind of, you know, coming into his agency, but in fact maybe is something very different. Discuss.
Yeah. We have to discuss it in relation to the cuts that the censor made, because otherwise we'd be here for 4 hours instead of two. So if we want to talk about, I suppose, the cuts that the censor made because it is passed on appeal, it is initially banned. The censor, first of all, says no bloody way. Distributors appeal it. And after 11 cuts, it's passed with an 18 certificate. So you have to be 18 or over to watch it in Ireland.
That's maybe something we should just briefly touch on, is that we're at this moment where the structure of film censorship changes slightly. We have a new censor appointed, but he's kind of much of the same. But there's a new appeals board, and with them comes the introduction of like limited certificates. So there's like over 12s with an adult, then there's over 16s, then there's over 18s, and then there's over 21s, which is, I think, very seldom used. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so there's this finally this sense after, you know, 40 years or more, that actually maybe what's suitable for a 10-year-old isn't the same thing as what's suitable for a 30-year-old.
So adults can actually get to see this film, but they don't get to see the film that we watched.
Again, the film that they must have gotten to see makes no sense.
No sense. I mean, we're working here from Kevin Rockett's brilliant book, you know, the film Censorship Bible. And he goes into detail of the cuts. And I suppose the first one, if we're talking about tan lines, I don't think they got to see anything apart from the tan line, you know, of when she comes in the door and she closes the door and turns around. You get to see the first shot is just her shoulders up, and you can see that she has a tan line. And then the camera kind of does these quick cuts of various naked parts of her body.
It is an amazing kind of sequence, both in terms of having, you know, a real sort of frisson to it, but also just being really funny. Like it's kind of focalized through his absolutely paralyzed, like, oh my god, there's a naked woman, I have no idea what to do with this. And that's kind of simulated by microsecond sort of cuts to like a nipple, like, you know, the tan line where her underwear, like her, you know, above her hips. It's, you know, it's just flashes of like, usually accompanied by Dustin Hoffman, just kind of making these like whimpers.
Yeah, these kind of noises in his throat of, oh god, like he hasn't even gotten as far as saying oh god or swearing. He's just,
which is also something that gets cut. So there's some very, we'll cover this, but yeah, some very significant, you know, Jesus god knows that just nope.
I love the sequence with the cutting, because it is, I don't know where to look. But of course, when you don't know where to look, you always look at the thing you're not supposed to be looking at. So he is, of course, going, naked person, must not look. Ooh, naked, 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 naked. So they cut that.
And some of the film's most famous lines. So they're like, are you trying to seduce me, Mrs. Robinson? Would you like me to seduce you? You know, that goes as well. I think also that kind of, you know, I was surprised by how briefly it lingers on screen, but you know, that very famous shot, shot from under her stockinged leg. I think even that's gone.
Yes.
Notwithstanding it being like the image of this movie.
Yeah, in the film poster art, that is one of the key selling points.
Mm.
So I don't really know what film poster they used or how it made sense. But yeah, so there are some of the most important iconic moments of the film cut. But I suppose the part that disturbed me the most is the part where they are in bed together and they have their most significant conversation, because they don't really do a lot of conversation that isn't quite transactional and quite blunt. But this is when he tries to talk to her. He's like, can we not just talk for a change? And she eventually reluctantly gives in and they have like a proper conversation. And much of that was cut.
This moment of where the kind of physical nudity is finally matched by, you know, a similar sort of emotional exposure where she talks about how the only reason that she's married to her husband is because she fell pregnant and that, you know, compromised her studies. Like she, you know, was studying art, but now kind of, you know, talks about it with like deliberate disinterest. And it becomes clear that she's this very sort of thwarted figure. But the thing that I find really disturbing about the sort of cuts to this scene is you lose all of the stuff where she, you know, communicates how confined her life has become. But the one thing that makes it through is the moment where Benjamin's like, well, yeah, this is the most perverted thing I've ever done. I am ashamed to come here and, you know, spend time with this washed up alcoholic.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So the film, the censor is like, yeah, you can be misogynistic to this woman. That's fine. Like, you can say that it's her fault and that this is disgusting, but we can't humanize her.
Yeah, that was devastating to me because I found that particular exchange so moving in terms of what it's trying to do about the adult persona of Mrs. Robinson, as opposed to what we think the film is about, which is about the young man coming of age. This is about someone who has come of age, but whose coming of age was determined by an accidental pregnancy, that because of the morality of the time, she felt she had really little choice but to marry the man who had fathered the child. So she's become trapped by that decision, and she's still trapped 20 years later, and she's in suburbia with no options, no outlets, and clearly did not have a vision of herself as suburbia. I think the fact that she was doing art is very telling, that she was doing something very creative that was possibly going to lead to like a sexy job in New York, and instead she's sitting in the burbs smoking cigarettes.
And like exercising power in the limited ways she can, right? I mean, she's almost invariably costumed in like leopard print, and you know, their house looks kind of a bit like a jungle or a hot house. You know, we're back in Eleanor Glynn territory here in terms of sexy, you know, sort of feline, voracious figures. But like the way that she sort of toys with him is clearly meant to be some kind of compensatory measure for like the disempowerment she otherwise feels. And there's a really telling moment sort of late in the movie during that whole, you know, kind of, oh, we're going to like elope together, you know, let me get you out of the church stuff, where her mother, you know, where Mrs. Robinson, whose first name we never learn, which I find quite telling,
yeah,
rounds on her daughter and is like, it's too late, as in, you know, the marriage has taken place now, you can't go off with this guy. And Elaine says, it's not too late for me, which, you know, there it is, Elle, right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Initially, you sort of, one might be prompted by the film to think that her objection to Benjamin having a relationship with her daughter is principally born of being, I want Elaine to not be involved with anyone. I want her to have the opportunities that I didn't have. But it kind of becomes increasingly apparent that maybe it's more vindictive than that, that it's kind of, I don't want her to have the opportunities I didn't have, or...
Yeah, I was very confused by that, actually, because when she says to him, you know, you must never take her out, and he's like, yeah, sure. And then she's like really emphatic. She pulls his hair and he's like, okay. I mean, he had no intention of taking her out in the first place. But there's something very powerful about her possession of her child there, or her possession of him, kind of the two together, yoked together.
And the whole film turns on this kind of like intergenerational question of, you know, sort of agency. So some of there are these like delicious sequences early in the film where, you know, Benjamin on his 21st birthday emerges in scuba gear and is forced by his parents into the swimming pool, and then you get like POV shots of him being forced into, like, they're trying to drown him. But this thing of, yeah, like parents particularly sort of pressing their children into certain kind of life paths, and or even forcing them into life paths just by negation. Like the whole question of, would Benjamin have become as infatuated with Elaine as he did if he hadn't been forbidden from doing so?
And the whole Elaine is so strange in that he ends up running away with her, and that's, getting married to Elaine is exactly what his parents wanted.
Yeah, he, in terms of the execution of it cinematically, like the whole thing has this real fucking like pizzazz to it. The momentum of the film is so behind this, and it's like, yeah, you've rebelled into exactly what your parents wanted you to do, and then you wind up on a bus with someone you barely know, as the air slowly seeps from you and the sound of silence starts playing again, and you realize that maybe this is no escape at all, and you're still alienated.
Well, according to the documentary I watched, that final shot as they're sitting there and they kind of look a bit freaked out as the enormity of what they have done sinks in, that apparently was just the director, Mike Nichols, just left the camera roll. That wasn't like built into the script or into the instructions for the actors. He just left it on them to see what they would do. And of course, you can really feel that tension as they're like, is it over?
And you see, like, you know, Hoffman, like, sort of a smile flickers back as if he's, you know, kind of like, do I need to still be holding this? And then it kind of dies away again. Like, Mike Nichols, he got Best Director for this, and by God, it's deserved. Like, it is such a good kind of exercise in, like, control and, like, framing. The director of photography, is also, like, exceptional work. Like, it's such a... The visual language of this movie does so much of what, like, it kind of, the way it often operates in tension with, like, the dialogue or the kind of framing of scenes to sort of, you know, really give you a sense of what's happening is so good.
We have to talk about the cuts, though, at the end, that, you know, the scene in the church.
Yes!
The cuts imposed by the Irish censor there, which, wild, just wild. As we said, Benjamin arrives into the church, big hubbub. They start to run away. She joins him at the back of the church, and they're all kind of fighting, and there's a bit of a melee. So he needs a weapon, And what else is to hand at a church except a cross that was handily by the front door? So he picks up the cross and starts wielding it around as if it's some sort of battle axe, scares them all away with the cross. They run out the door, and then he closes the door and he uses the cross to jam the handles together. And then the shot is of them running hand in hand down the driveway, and you can see the door held together with the cross. Benjamin trying to kill people with the cross, not allowed in the Irish version of this film.
The board still had a Catholic and a Protestant member of the clergy on it at this point. I think it's worth pointing out. The appeals board did.
They'd be wildly offended that you use the church to aid your elopement.
Yes, your kind of extramarital. Because they, I guess, like, in the eyes, at least, I don't know if the, you know, registry has been signed, but the rights have been, you know, you, like, she is married to your man, like, yes, religiously. So you can't swing a giant gold crucifix around like a like a bludgeon.
And it's such a, I mean, I don't know what the film must have looked like with these cuts, because I just can't imagine the ending. They presumably are in the church and then suddenly they're outside the church without really having a fight. That must have been what happened.
He knocks her father down, and beyond that, they would just sort of like teleport outside, basically. It's just one of those things where, you know, so much of what makes this film sing are those sorts of, you know, small details, or those, you know, these little kind of either dry kind of tonal moments in dialogue or little flashes of sort of flourish. And the censor in this instance basically manages to go through and just cream off everything that like takes it from being a sort of conventional coming of age story with this, you know, sort of added element of like, ooh, the mother, into being something like really special. So it's just, yeah, such a kind of weird, neutered version of the film.
By reducing Mrs. Robinson's proposition, which is like deeply shocking, to a flirtation, which is just slightly awkward, perhaps.
But also, like, it with her sort of proposition, it's simultaneously like there's the, like, the film does and doesn't present it as scandalous. Like, it's really interesting the way it's sort of, you know, she executes it with such sort of elan. It's clear that, you know, she knows exactly what she's doing and how to handle this guy. Paired with his sacrification, her capacity to kind of manage him, but also, like, the delicious comedy of how sort of wrong-footed he is. Yeah, it makes it a more old-fashioned, like, issues drama of, like, you know, this predatory older woman, you know, rather than that it is in the film as it actually is rendered.
Yeah, it is very complicated with questions of her control and his complicity. It goes back and forth in ways that you're like, I mean, he is an adult, but at the same time, he's not. And also when she makes the proposition, she comes in and she closes the door behind her. And he says, Mrs. Robinson, open the door. And she doesn't. And
she locks it and she interposes herself naked between
exactly
him and the door.
You know, and there's like, that is such a like, whoa, that is creepy. But also it's not creepy the way she does it in some strange way.
It also, like, Len resonates with what he does in terms of like his manipulative behavior toward Elaine and the way he intrudes upon her. Like, it's, you know, there's a sort of Russian nesting doll of like people exerting kind of coercive control over one another in this movie. There's something really fascinating about how in the pursuit of, you know, a kind of more conventionally sexually sanitized version of this story, the film becomes so much more misogynistic.
Yes, and what it also does in one of the cuts is really let the Benjamin character off the hook when he really is horrible to Elaine when they go on the date and he takes her to a strip club.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So just to explain the sort of plot element of this, if you haven't seen the movie, this is after he's been told in no uncertain terms, you know, you are not to go out with my daughter. And his parents sort of, you know, force his hand, pose like, oh, well, we'll just have all of the Robinsons over for dinner, which for understandable reasons would be the most awkward thing in the world.
Can you imagine? Wow.
He's like, okay, fine, look, I'll take her for a date. And then he goes on to kind of try and imagine like the worst possible date he could take her on. So he like drives like a maniac, barely communicates with her, takes her to a strip club, and then, you know, humiliates her by you know, in the way he talks to her while she's there. But again, in a way that the film makes like really dryly funny, it's something like you're missing a great show, or like you're missing a great kind of sequence or something. Like you're missing great technique as this woman is like spinning her tassels. And then he's like, can you do that? Which is, you know, what tips poor Elaine, just kind of weeping. At which point he's like, oh, I actually do feel some sympathy for her. And he takes off his, you know, sunglasses and lets her in a bit.
Yeah, and they cut the sequence with the tassels on the boobs, obviously. And like, without that, the full enormity of how much of a shit he is really reduced, you know? You really are like, he's being rude, obviously, but you kind of know that he's in a difficult position. But with that particular moment, it just goes way beyond just being rude.
It's so exorbitantly cruel to this, you know, poor young woman who, it's very like, she asks him, like, have I done something to you? Like, is there a reason you hate me? Like, what did I do to deserve this?
I mean, she has no idea what's going on. She's just been asked out on a date by someone who she probably knew as a child.
Even afterward, they sort of go outside and he's like, he makes an effort toward explaining himself and he sort of apologizes, but pretty just about at the point at which he sort of stops crying, he also kisses her. And I do think the film is cognizant, or wants us to be cognizant, of all that being kind of intrusive as well. You know, like Elaine, bless her, like really is something of an innocent in all this and like really trying her best. You know, he tells her eventually that he's been involved with some, you know, there's a point where they wind up at the hotel together, and everyone in the hotel, because he's been going again with her mother, everyone in the hotel is like, oh, hello, Mr. Gladstone, you know, like recognizes him, like all the staff are kind of saying hello to him because he's been there so often under this pseudonym. And so she asks him like, what, you know, have you, and he sort of comes clean and she's like, well, that's fine. Like, you know, it's like she really does seem to be just a pretty level-headed, kind of open-hearted person. And he's a complete shit to her. And then he stalks her and coerces her into like being in a relationship with him again. Like, it's, notwithstanding the fact that it's a film from 1967, like the film wants you to recognize that that's not good.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I had a tiny moment of, yes, it is stalky to go all that way. I mean, to move into a lodging house and to spend your time hanging around a campus looking for someone. But on the other hand, before mobile phones, there was no real way to know where people were except to hang around.
Yes.
In the hopes that they would walk by. I mean, this is, you know, experience from college. You would just go to the whatever canteen it was and be like, they're often here at 12:30. It's worth a shot.
It struck me in a very sort of mobile phone kind of way. That like, Elaine is gone and you'll never see her again. It's like, you couldn't do it. Like, yeah. You know. In an age of social media, there is no hope of that. Yeah, the last act of this movie would just be like, goes on Instagram, finds wedding location.
Yeah, because somebody will have put a picture of the church, matched the picture of the church. There you go.
It's like asking, like, oh, should we go get the blood test together?
What was that about?
It's in order to get a marriage license in the US, you have to test negative for syphilis.
Good God, still?
Yeah. I don't know if it's to this day, but I'm all but certain that's a Wasserman test. Yeah.
Crikey.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, at that stage, you would still have had sterilization laws on the books in some US states. Like, it was still constitutional at that point. Like, so eugenics is still a part of American sort of and kind of medical sort of law at this point.
Man. It's, yeah. So fucked up.
It's just really gross, isn't it?
I should have known you'd know the answer to that one, because when it popped up, I was like, what are they talking about a blood test for? Why? Yeah.
No, I was like, oh, yep, no, I've got this one.
Queen of syphilis that you are.
Jesus.
No, that's not.
It's an epithet I will happily take. Being in a position where throughout your entire PhD people can just walk up to you and be like, "So Lloyd, how's the syphilis?" is in public settings is that was great. Loved that for me.
Look, if you can style that out, you can really get away with anything. I have a really fun fact, actually, about the artwork for this movie, yeah, for The Graduate. I heard this on the radio and then I checked it. And it's true. But do you know who Sue Ellen from Dallas was?
I'm familiar with Dallas more through like parody and, you know, kind of clip shows than the full bore sort of experience. I'm a wee shade too young.
Okay, for our older listeners like me, Dallas was an American soap opera that was wildly popular in Ireland, and I presume everywhere else as well. But Sue Ellen was married to J.R. Ewing, the main bad guy, and the actress there was Linda Gray. And fun fact, Linda Gray is the one who's putting the stocking on in the poster.
Ah, okay. So the poster is not kind of a frame from the film, it's like that was a staged sort of still, or is it that she was the leg model in the...
I think she was the leg model in the film. Damn. Yeah. She was paid $25. No residuals, so she didn't make any money afterwards.
I was going to say, absolutely immortalized. It sort of, it reminds me of, you know, the woman who's painted gold in Goldfinger in the credits isn't the actress who plays the character that gets painted gold.
These bodies become iconic images, yeah. Just, you know, bodies in the moment of the film.
Absolutely.
Loved watching The Graduate.
This was an utter delight, and a completely unexpected one. I mean, it's also, it just made me watch more Mike Nichols, because I'd not realized that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was him, which, you know, he in the space of 2 years, his first movie's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and then this. And it's so, you know, he's up for Best Director twice, Best Picture twice. Like, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, I think, was up for every Oscar category it was eligible for. Like, he just storms it. I think one of only 18 people to ever get an EGOT. Like, Emmy, Golden Globe, Oscar, Tony.
And apparently that little strange strangled sound that Dustin Hoffman makes as Benjamin was borrowed from Mike Nichols.
Right.
He had that little tick sometimes when he would be nervous or excited. And Hoffman heard it and thought, that's good.
It works. Like the, that first moment when he's confronted, you know, having her slam the door, he lets out this little whimper and it is just the funniest thing. He is a cornered animal.
There are so many funny movie moments, though. Actually, I'm going to tell you, you can tell me your favorite one. My favorite one is when they're in the hotel room for the first time and he's trying to work out what he should do. And he decides, well, obviously I should kiss her. So he goes and she's leaning nonchalantly against a table. She has a cigarette in one hand. She takes a drag. He comes and stands right in her space. And he goes to kiss her and then he goes, puts his head aside, goes, and she's got the smoke in her mouth. And then he leans in and kisses her and she's holding the smoke.
Yeah, she has this, and then she lets out this long exhale of smoke. Yeah.
I was like, that is fucking brilliant. That is perfect.
It's those little, like, kind of details that make the whole thing sing. There's, I mean, yeah, I have, like, a Rolodex of lines from this that really crack me up. But I think my favorite just little dry thing is, much as Benjamin's a bit, is in sort of full unpleasant mode at this point. It's in the zoo whenever the date is striding toward them. And he's like, he's a very good walker. It's just such a little kind of dry, pissy thing. He's a very good walker.
And it's nice to know that those two examples we have cited were not caught by the Irish censor.
Yes, impervious to to censorship. But yeah, if you haven't seen this, listeners, like, strong recommend. It's a real delight. And we haven't even talked about the soundtrack either, right? Like, you know, the use of Simon and Garfunkel is, it's good.
I mean, you could talk about this film for, I mean, there's so much in it. It's just, but we can't do that because I have to edit.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.